Welcome back, or welcome to, if it's your first time, is how I normally open a Backhouse Jones broadcast. But I can't say welcome back on this occasion because this is the first podcast in the series titled The Backstory. And the backstory is the background, it's the narrative history, the chronological order, the history of a character in the drama. So today's backstory is all about looking back and mostly about the flume of entrepreneurship and looking at the long view and going back to the beginning of the long view. I wanted to call it Friends in High and Low Places, but thought that that would be inappropriate. But I've started today with this podcast with one of my first clients who has become a friend, and I've got many clients who become friends. But this is the only one that within Backhouse Jones we call Uncle. And so this is Uncle Les, who is a bus legend. And for those of you who know the bus industry will know there's two Leses in the bus industry, both of whom are legends. But I'm going to start today with Les Burton. So I started acting for Stagecoach in 1993. And Stagecoach arrived in Manchester in 1995, and I met Les Burton shortly thereafter. But now, just going back to 1995, it was a bit like the Californian gold rush after deregulation in the bus industry. And just as a matter of interest, the Californian gold rush was started in 1848 when a gentleman called James W. Marshall found some gold nuggets at Souter's Mills in Coloma, California. Now, there's a bit of a irony and coincidence. So Stagecoach arrived in Manchester and looked at the mountain range and spat on their hands and sunk their picks into the soil and decided to build an empire. And it needed chaps and ladies to do this. And Les Burton is one of the integral members of the Stagecoach team in the Northwest. And so he likes railways as well as buses. So I've started with this introduction for him. And in the 1800s, they decided to build a railway across America. And so the Central Pacific Railway Company started with a collection of Chinese labourers who started working east. And the Irish started working west. And they met in the Utah Desert in May 1869. When two locomotives timidly nosed together and a young lad climbed up the telegraph pole and sent a telegraph message saying, "The last rail is laid, the last spike has been driven, and the Pacific Railway is finished." Which was not quite the end of the story, because the Irish and the Chinese took against each other and decided to start throwing dynamite at each other, and literally many men died. The reason for that is Les has had some fireworks as he created the Manchester and Liverpool corridor. It's not quite the transcontinental railway, but he started in Manchester, then went across to Liverpool to start Stagecoach Merseyside, and in doing so created the East Lancashire corridor for Stagecoach. So Les has told me one of the best phrases ever, and he said to me years ago, "Recruit for character, train for skill." So Les Burton, what were you like when you started back in the 1960s, I presume?
1962, as a junior clerk at the former Northwestern Road Car Company at their head office at Charles Street. And I started by picking the mail up every morning at 8 o'clock. And then you had to deliver it to head office and clock on for 8:45. It was interesting times. I learnt a lot about pence per mile, pence per car mile, operating costs and wages. But sadly, they only paid 84 shillings a week. And bus conductors in those days were earning £11.
A fortune.
And I went home. And I told my parents I was going on the buses. My father went absolutely ballistic. I worked overtime to give you an education. And you're going on the buses. A bus conductor. he was not happy, happy chappy.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a bit of a culture shock getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah, having to walk to work. But I survived it. And then when I was 21, I became a driver.
Right.
I was very fortunate. 3 months after I was 21, I passed my test in the August. And I carried on. And then one afternoon, I came in the office to sign on for my late finish. And I had to see the assistant traffic manager. Well, in those days, if you saw the assistant traffic manager, you were going in the office with trepidation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, knocked on the door, entered, and it really was, enter. Ah, Burton. Sutcliffe's had a heart attack. You understand private hire. Go and see Harrop. He'll tell you what you're doing. We don't want you to lose any money, so I've sorted it out with the trade union, what you're going to get paid.
Yeah, yeah.
That was it. I went to see the private hire superintendent. He gave me a phone and said, there's a quote here, you can sort that out. So I was in there, I was turned off the road, didn't go back on my late finish, finished at half past five, went home at half past five.
Yeah.
I stayed in there for 12 months, went back on the road, and I was going out with a girl who worked at another garage at Door Bank.
Yeah, yeah.
And
Stockport.
She said, I was away, I was on London duties, I was all over the place. And she said, oh, there's a vacancy for an inspector at my garage. Why don't you apply for it? So I thought, well, applicator, I'll apply for it. And now, the district manager never appointed anybody out with his own garage, ever.
Yeah, yeah,
it's unheard
yeah.
of. So I thought, I'm on a winner here. I'll keep in her good books and I'll apply for the job. And to my surprise, and it was a surprise, Roger Bowker, who is a stagecoach stalwart, was then the operations superintendent at Door Bank. And he gave me the job. I was shocked.
Yeah.
But it was very good because the district manager was a chap called Fred Kennington. And he was affectionately known to as the weasel because he used to slink around. But he knew.
Not very affectionate. Did he know he was called the weasel?
He knew. He used to live on the main corridor, on the 192 corridor.
Yeah.
And he used to walk to work every morning. And he could tell you exactly how the buses were running.
Yeah.
He's almost on a par with Les Warnford.
Right.
He really, really knew everything about everything.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic manager. And I was privileged to work for him. And then in 1981, as it became the PTE, Greater Manchester PTE, and they were famous for reorganisations, I got reorganised to Princess Road.
Yeah.
In Moss Side, and I was considered a bit of a yokel coming from Stockport, but
yeah,
I managed to survive there for 4 years, and then deregulation came along in 1985, and I moved back to Princess Road as the senior inspector.
That's where I think I met you at Princess Road.
That's right, yeah. And then I was there for 4 years. It was a bit, we had some good times there. We had the advent of Beeline, we had Walls, Finglands, Tame Valley, Uncle Tom Cobley and all on Wilmslow Road, all wanting to get in the trough.
The bus wars, basically.
Yeah. No, it wasn't the bus war as such, it was
healthy competition.
Healthy competition.
Yeah, as Nicholas Ridley envisaged.
It was indeed.
Sir Nicholas Ridley, I think.
Yeah. Or Nasty Nicky. But we, it was strange times because I got summoned to see the chairman of the PTA, who said to us, "You need to give Walls a bit of slack." And I'm sort of looking at him, and he said, "Well, we repair their buses." So on the road, they're competing against us on the road.
Yeah.
And in the garages, we're repairing the buses. Really, really silly situation.
Yeah.
But, and then, in, subject to another reorganisation, I ended up as acting operations manager at Queen's Road on the north of the city.
Yeah.
And
I know it well.
Yeah, it really was.
It's where your double-decker bus is.
Still there.
Still there.
Two of them are still
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
right. Yeah,
yeah. yeah. It was famous for being militant. They were so far left of centre, it was unreal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never forget turning up on the first day and the union fella coming barging in and saying, banging on the, he was banging on the table. And I'm not used to this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
After a few expletives, he got the message, and he came back in and knocked on the door.
Yeah,
and we did it properly.
Yes,
and that was my first really senior management role, and I was there for 2 years, and we managed to turn the place around, and it was a good depot, and. I was in a meeting one afternoon with the trade union, and the company was being split.
Yeah.
And I was undecided where to go. So I'm talking to the trade union. The trade union says to me, "I don't know what you're bothered about. Knocking a line off the rotor at Queen's Road for, you're going to Oldham next week." And I looked at the district manager and he says, "You don't know, do you?" I said, "I don't. Can we have an adjournment?"
Yeah.
So
is it the trade union official telling you where you're going?
Yeah. which in those days, I mean, you know, I had a trade union official tell me early on in my career that if I didn't stop being a plank, he'd have me shifted to Wigan. But, joking apart, you know, doubtless they could do it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they had the ear of the councils.
Right, okay.
But, so anyway, we have an adjournment.
Yeah.
And I'm in the office, and I'm off. I am seriously not happy, and I'm off on one. And the personnel manager's going, he's nodding his head, and I'm saying to him, "Stop nodding your flipping head, will you?"
Yeah, yeah.
And behind me, unbeknown to me, was Dr. Westwell, the chief exec.
Right.
And he said, "Calm down, calm, you know."
Yeah, 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 yeah.
"I'm sure we can sort it out." And he phoned me the following day and invited me for dinner. And he offered me Wigan.
My hometown, be careful what you say.
By country. 70-mile round trip from where I live.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I tried to negotiate a salary, and he's a bit reluctant to pay me what I think I'm worth. And then I got offered the job at Princess Road, and I thought, well, it's around the corner from where I live.
Yeah.
It's a big depot. I've been there before. I know it.
Yeah.
So I moved to Princess Road, and then.
What year would that be?
1992.
Right.
So then, we had in the interim we'd had Merseybus come over, wanted to take the world over.
Yeah. Came over to Manchester.
Came over to Manchester.
Right.
So we had, John Young and I went down to Liverpool, Birkenhead, found a nice little niche for us in Birkenhead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Set up an operation. And Keith Garvey, who was the district manager at MTL at the time, said to me, "You'll be here 3 months and we'll see you off." Right. As I said, "Tell you what, if I'm still here in 3 months, you can take me for dinner in the Carnarvon Castle."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sure enough, 3 months later, he's having to take me for lunch in the Carnarvon Castle.
Yeah.
But as an adjunct from that, he subsequently got moved from Birkenhead to Green Lane.
Yeah.
And we we sort of lost touch. But in 2013, we took over first in Chester and Wrexham.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
And the transport coordinator for Wrexham was none other than Keith Garvey.
It's a small business, this.
Small business.
It is, yeah.
So, we did very well in Birkenhead, and I was subsequently interviewed by the Monopolies and Mergers Competition Commission, under caution, and I think the guy must have liked talking to me because he came up from London first class every time he spoke to me.
Yeah.
And in the end, it was deemed that we'd done nothing wrong, and went to award.
Yeah.
And then along came Stagecoach, and I was I got the impression that everything I did was wrong.
Right. What did you think when they, what was your preconception of Stagecoach before they actually arrived?
They're the worst employers. Everybody, Barry Inkley was famous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With the Friday afternoon brown envelope.
Right.
And
what's the Friday envelope? Explain the Friday afternoon brown envelope.
There it is, here's your wages, bugger off. And it was as simple as that.
Yeah, it was, had your P45 in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So you had, I wasn't 50 at the time, so I had the opportunity, you had the opportunity to elect for redundancy, and I was in the local government pension scheme.
Yeah.
So I could have activated my pension at 50. And the redundancy package was quite good.
Yeah.
And I obviously put in for redundancy because I had a couple of offers of work. Mm. And I got a phone call. It was, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm in Warrington shopping with my wife." Well, you know, I'll come to see you. I'll see you.
Who's this?
Les
Warnford, yeah.
I've got some good news and some bad news.
Okay. The Cardigan Man.
Yeah, the Cardigan Man. Absolutely. Star. The good news is, you're not going. The bad news is, you're going to Hyde Road and Glossop. All right. 1st of January. Right. Is that all right? Yeah. Mm. So, that was it. And, you know, Les is an absolute star. I've got to say, you know, I've done a few daft things in my time, but he's always backed me up.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've, Hyde Road had a bit of a problem with attendance. That was my first job. We managed to turn it round. And
how did you do that?
Good advice from Backhouse Jones. No, that's one thing about, you know, the PTE. The PTE taught, you know, the rights and wrongs of doing things right.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, June Ashton, who headed up at the HR pack. You could always phone her and get good advice.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you didn't phone her and didn't take her advice, you were daft.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I've not lost a tribunal in all my career.
You've been great for our business, Les. We had to, when you retired, we considered making redundancies, but...
So we did... So I moved to High Road in Glossop. And then Elizabeth Tasker called us in one afternoon, and there was three traffic managers then. And she said, I'm making redundancies. We're doing away with the role of the traffic manager.
Yeah.
And we're having a service delivery manager and a network manager. So, well, I had 40 odd years in, so I'm top of the list.
Yeah.
So I went on to my wife and said, hey, looks like I might be redundant. And she's, oh well, house is paid for, don't worry about it. So I waited the following morning and I was told I was the new service delivery manager. One of the other guys that he'd elected to take the money.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And I was the new service delivery manager. All right. And that was it. And then I was working with Tom Wildman, and things just took off.
Right.
Absolutely.
Why did it work with Tom?
Because we've got the same history.
Yeah.
We've got the same track record.
Why do you think Stagecoach succeeded in Manchester so well? What do you think they brought to what do you think Stagecoach brought to Manchester that made them come to dominate the city?
Reliability. We ran everything. And we improved the product. We bought new buses.
Yeah.
A philosophy that what's ours is ours.
Yeah.
And there's a lot been said about deregulation and its faults. But you know, if you're running banger buses, you can't keep it up.
Yeah.
And a lot of the newcomers were running 15, 20-year-old buses. And they were just interested in making a quick buck.
Yeah.
And sadly, the political climate in Manchester centred around the mess that allegedly deregulation had caused.
Yeah.
Certainly, we developed routes that originally were minibus routes that were low floor single decks from minibuses to 44 seaters, from 44 seaters to 75 seaters.
Yes.
And we grew the market. We were innovative. Yes, and, I remember Altery going out with Tom one night and we were looking in the summer. We generally reduce the service in line with the university.
Yeah.
And we could save quite a lot of money with it. But we were looking at other areas in which we could grow the market. And we were in Stretford one evening and we had two services, 256 and 257, and they were every 30 minutes. That made a combined 15-minute service, and the 257 went off the beaten track and came back, joined the 256 route further down the road. But if you looked at the demographics of the route, the focal points were primarily Stretford.
Yeah.
So we were in a pub having our tea and we've got a beer mat and we're working out how many buses we'd need to alter it. And we did away with the 257 and made the 256 every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And the growth on it was fantastic. And to some degree, we covered it up from Les Warneford by introducing it at the end of the academic university year.
Yeah.
And in October, we had these quarterly meetings. And Les said, come here, you. When did you do the 256? I think it might have been May, Les, when we, you might have told me, he said, I was with Bob Hine the other day, he said, and he said, you have ripped him off. So I said, oh, in future, he said, if you're going to do anything, just tell me, will you? Because Les had an uncanny knack of finding out if you did do anything, he knew about it before you did. He knew everything. How he managed to keep on top of everything across the UK buses, absolutely. You know.
I heard Sir Brian speak at the CPC conference in Scotland a few years back, and he was saying that he owed much of the success in Manchester to Les Warneford.
Oh.
And I think it's sort of that what you've identified there, and I've been dealing with Stagecoach throughout the 90s and well, for the past 25 years, and there's a... It's a really good company, and the way it was structured, it was very much, it was like a family-orientated company. And what I found was that people could be offered more money to go and work somewhere else, but they just wouldn't go because if you cut them in half, they literally were Stagecoach through and through. And I could never imagine if someone offered to top your salary, I couldn't imagine you leaving Stagecoach to go to another company. And there was something there, a confluence of ideas and economics and entrepreneurship and family collegiate field that literally made it into the company it was in the 90s and 2000s.
Indeed. I listened to Brian at an Institute of Transport talk at Runcorn Town Hall.
Right.
And that was probably in the late 80s. And we turned up, a couple of us turned up there, and there was a free buffet, so we thought we'd get there a bit early and make sure that we get something to eat. And this guy comes in with a carrier bag, and he says, I'm at the Institute of Transport.
Yeah.
So he says, all right. So I said, oh, this guy's supposed to be quite sharp.
Yeah.
So... he says, well, I hope I am. He says, oops.
Did he have his red kick or something?
Yep, and his cards. And he said, you're right. He said, I'm singing for my supper tonight.
Yeah.
So we had quite an interesting chat, actually.
Yeah.
And at the time,
year would this be? When would this be?
88.
Right, yeah, so literally at the very start of it.
Because we were only roommasters in those days.
Yeah.
And of course they had a load of them all over the place. And I was interested in getting my feet under the table to get some parts.
Yeah.
So we used to... So he gave me this guy's card, gave me his card, and he said, wrote this guy's number on the back of it, and said, tell him you can speak to me.
Yeah.
You know. So sure enough, this is in 1988, we're getting Routemaster parts from Perth, coming down on the overnight Aberdeen, and we're picking them up at Charlotte Richard.
Yeah.
And then to sort of go just to sort of an anecdote thing, in 1990, I got a phone call, and there's one of these near plans of Stagecoach on the viaduct at Thelwall.
Yeah.
Can you help me out? So I'm obliged to help him out.
Yeah.
So I have to send two metro buses that will do 45 mile an hour flat out with the wind behind them over to Thelwall, and there's two drivers on this stagecoach, fortunately. So they put the luggage on one and passengers on another. But they take it off. They take them off at Carlisle, and what happens is they end up running them on the 61 in Carlisle.
Yeah.
Of course, some silly anorak bus spotter takes a picture of it. It appears in one of the local trade magazines, and I get a phone call. What are Airbus doing? You know.
Yeah.
5308 and 5309. What were they doing in Carlisle? But we got paid, so I was saved by the bell. But he was very, very, very interesting, and it could talk to him.
Yeah.
I remember Barry Hinckley turning up at the office at Princes Road, and he said, "It's a bit grand noir, isn't it?" We're, you know, we had a coal fire in the office and everything in those days.
Yeah.
And he said, "We won't have this here for long." Fortunately, the building was listed, so they couldn't knock it down. But in true style, they moved us into where we were divorced from the garage.
Yeah.
So we were moved into.
Because it was the olden days. It was very hierarchical bus companies.
Oh,
it was,
yeah. Oh yeah.
And there's the story of Sir Brian going to, I think it was Cheltenham and Gloucester, and they had a washroom for the executives and one for the drivers. And
oh, yeah.
Brian was in there, and some guy said, "What?" I think he presumed he was a driver. And he said to Sir Brian, "What are you doing in here?" He said, "Just bought the company, mate, just bought the company." So there was a transition, wasn't there, in the 90s between the hierarchical, sort of structured way of the old moving into real capitalism, but capitalism with a heart in many ways. Oh, yeah. It was a very friendly organisation. And it was that transition that you lived through at that time. And it was a real, it was sort of Thatcherite politics, if you like, being put into action in the bus industry.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. I think, you know, when I first started, you know, you push the button on the manager's door and it was red, yellow and green.
Yeah.
And you know, when I was a junior, it was Burton. It wasn't Les, it was Burton.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Mr. Leaves was the general manager.
Yes, yeah.
And to some degree, it was perpetuated at the PTE. It was always Mr. Ludham and Mr. Bradshaw. Whereas, there's one thing about, you know, stagecoach. It brought you down to the ground.
Yeah.
You know, you could actually not wear a tie as well.
Yeah. It was very meritocratic, I always found it. And it was this, when we would go to Perth, there literally would be sort of, it was still the family company run from above the travel agents at Charlotte Terrace.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I was amazed by Stagecoach is there was not many layers of managers. There's not many layers of managers, literally from the driver right up to the chief executive was probably four different hierarchies.
That's right.
And that's why it was allowed, that's why it was successful, in that it was just concentrating on the job, getting the buses running, looking after the punter.
The priority was, you know, run the bus. If you don't run the bus, you lose money.
Yeah.
You fail mileage, you lose money. And it's a fact of life. And as you say, the man, you were allowed within certain tolerances to do what you want.
Yeah.
If you wanted to, you know, put a new route on, you go, you know, you put it to Les, and Les would go, "Oh dear, go on then." You know.
Okay, I'm not sure whether it's for broadcast or not, but one of your colleagues told me that you and Tom Wildman were like the Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro characters in Goodfellas. You're sort of you're literally out there carving out these routes and creating them, and literally building this network like mining for gold in the 1800s. And this particular individual, when they first came to Stagecoach, someone said, "Well, you go with those two. If you can survive those two, you can survive anything." And this person has gone on to survive. He's doing quite well at Stagecoach, but that was the reputation you had. So, and what I'm fast, I in my career, I went from Liverpool, where I was born, from did my training, and I went down the East Lancashire Road to Manchester. And you did the opposite.
Yeah.
You went from Manchester, and you literally went down the East Lancashire Road to create the Merseyside, Stagecoach Merseyside operation. Just tell us how that came about. And I know there's some anecdotes from your encounters with my brethren in Liverpool, but how did a Manchester chap do in Liverpool, and what were you there to do when you bought Glenvale?
I had a phone call one afternoon, and I was in the car, and it was LBW.
Yeah.
And he said, "What are you doing tonight?" So I said, "Don't know. Linda won't mind if you stay out, will he?" No. Right. "Do you know where the Sweets Hotel is in Knowsley?" So I said, "I do, aye."
Yeah.
He says, so I said to him, "You've not bought Glenvale, have you?" And he goes, "I'll see you later."
LBW is Les Warnford for those of you who are listening. Yeah.
So I turn up at the Sweets Hotel and he says, "I don't like the menu here, it's too posh."
Yeah.
I said, "Do you know anywhere decent?" So I said, "Oh," I said, "we've got Queens we'll go to the Carvery on the Queens."
Yeah.
So we go and have the Carvery. And he says, "Right," he said, "phone your secretary in the morning, tell her you're in Scotland for a month." "Right, I want you to come here," he says, "and I want a business plan off you in a month."
Yeah.
He said, "But I'll keep in touch with you. Tell me what's what." So we had a ride on a few buses, and I was absolutely shocked. I have never seen fiddling on such a scale in all my life.
Yeah.
I got on a 19 on a Sunday morning, and the driver issued no tickets, but 62 people travelled on the bus at £1.20 each,
yeah,
me included.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. I've never seen anything like it. I was in a cafe in Liverpool where the bus drivers congregated, and I heard this guy say, "I'm on holiday tomorrow, I've not made a penny yet." I had to get off his bus. I got on his bus and I had to get off at Formby. He went from Liverpool to Formby and he was going to Southport, and he never issued a ticket.
Yeah.
And that wasn't just one or two. Everybody was at it. I mean, when Sir Brian and I were looking at, buying MTL in its entirety.
Yeah.
We rode on several buses, and in those days, it was common knowledge. If you knew anything about the bus industry, you could pay 50 pence and travel all day.
Yeah.
And we went to Bootle. I paid the 50 pence, for both of us going out.
Yeah.
And he said, "I'll have to try that coming back." We came back and did the same thing. He gave him £2 for 2 50 pences. And when you think about it, we sort of sat down afterwards and he said, what do you think you can save at Liverpool?
Yeah.
You could save, apart from the obvious, reducing the fleet, reducing the staff, they must have been losing £5 or £6 million a year in theft.
Yes, yeah.
It's frightening.
Well, I remember saying to you, at the time, it was and you corrected me, I said, apparently it was £1 for the company, £1 for the driver, £1 for the company, £1 for the driver. And you said, no. It's £1 for the company, £5 for the driver.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I mean, I've never seen anything like it.
So how you turned it round? What without mentioning numbers, but like in percentage terms, what did it go from when you started to the end?
Nil.
Pardon?
Nil. I got there on, I do a business plan for Letts.
Yeah.
And then we look at the route network, what you need to do at the route network. Apart from the thieving, I could say that's easy.
Yeah.
The route network was, it hadn't been altered since the 30s. And some of the routes were tram routes, still tram routes. cross city routes. It was, and the people that were running it from the sale from Arriva to GTL were just not interested. They were just in it for the money.
Yeah.
But they didn't have an idea, and they'd done nothing. No innovation, no nothing. They just bought a load of old second-hand buses and just run it into the ground.
Yes, yes.
I mean, so I gave, you know, an update to Les sort of every other day, and then because he was the managing director there in those days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he said, "Oh, I used to miss him at McDonald's at Kirby."
Yeah.
And he used to say,
"All the hot spots." Yeah.
Oh yeah. He used to say, "I'm gonna have to get here earlier before the kids come out. It's too bloody noisy in here."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he said, "Have you you thought about coming here?" So I said, "Well, no, not really." I said, "I'm all right where I am.
Yeah,
you know, it's okay." I said, "You know, I'm comfortable in what I'm doing." He said, you could do worse than come here, you know." I said, "Right, well, I can't live here because for domestic reasons, my wife's mother wasn't too well."
Yes, yeah.
You know, so I can't live here. I said, "You know, no." I said, "Well, I'm all right where I am. Have a think about it. Talk to Linda," he said, "have a think about it." So he says, "I'll see you anyway next week." So I saw him on the Monday, Tuesday. And on the Thursday, he says to me, "Right, you start on Monday at 9 o'clock. I said, "All right." So we had a bit of a discussion about one or two things. "Oh, you can get a better car, you'll get a better car." And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
"It's a different bonus scheme," and so on. So he said, "Right," he said, "9 o'clock. And he said, "Don't come in here before 9 o'clock. Come in the office at 9 o'clock and I'll introduce you to everybody."
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm in this Greasy Spoon Cafe in Liverpool at about past seven on the Monday morning, having a look at what,
yeah,
thinking, oh dear, what have I said? And in walks LBW himself.
Yeah.
And he goes, "What are you doing here?" "Anyway, I told you 9 o'clock, so I'll see you at 9 o'clock. We have a piece of toast and a cup of tea." He clears off and I have a mooch around and then stroll up at the office at 9 o'clock. And he introduces me to everybody and then says, "Right, I'm off to my day job now. You'll be all right. I'm off to my day job." And what happened was, like, for the next few months, he used to turn up every Monday morning and say, "What have you done this week?" And then, closely followed by the trade union, he'd be knocking on the door complaining that what I had done the week before.
Yeah,
he used to say to me, "What have you done? What are they going to complain about this week?" Because it was the stories that you hear about Liverpool and the trade unions, to some degree, were true.
Yeah.
But the first week I was there, I took them, I hired a room at one of the local hotels, sat them all down and said, "You know, this is what we need to do. Stop the thieving, stop this." And a shopping list of things that I was going to do.
Yeah.
And one of them at the back said to me, "These socially necessary services, are you going to be putting socially right prices in?" So I said, "Well, if you're going to take socially right wages for it, I'll do them at socially right prices." And he got up and walked out. I can't understand why, but he did.
Yeah.
Walked out. And we weren't winning. We did, in reality, we didn't win that much because there was too many cheapskate operators around.
Yeah.
Who were prepared to do it for nothing. As in Manchester and in a lot of the Met counties, that the people that proliferated in the 80s have all gone to the wall because they can't afford to If you look at, replace their assets.
That's right. If you look at the investment that's going into, you know, the hydrogen buses and the electric buses.
Yeah, yeah.
The buses today, they just burn no. I know you've got a route master yourself, but you look at the transition, not from the route master of the 60s, but even in the past 20 years, the buses today have got Wi-Fi and they are they're bristling with all kinds of technology.
That's right.
It's amazing what the investment has done in the bus industry.
Simple things like contactless.
Yeah.
We pioneered contactless in Liverpool.
Yes.
And it didn't... The banks thought it, you know, that Liverpool was cash... was people tended to pay with cash.
Yes, yeah.
But it was... The equipment was... It was an adaptation to the ticket machine.
Yeah.
And I have to smile because the banks, you know, seem to have an unlimited amount of money to invest in it. But they were also interested in, excuse me, the Oyster card
in London, yeah.
In London.
Yeah.
And contactless in London.
Yes,
so yeah. So they were prepared to throw a load of money at it.
Yeah.
But we had this box put on the bus and it worked. I mean, we had it at an exhibition, a UTIP exhibition in Paris, you know. And I had a couple of good dinners out of Sent talking about it, and it really did work.
Yeah.
And of course now everybody takes it for granted, paying contactless.
The stagecoach I've innovated over the past 20
absolutely,
years.
Absolutely. We've done really well.
Yeah. Just to bring it to a conclusion, really. I know that your wife sort of despairs because you can be in the middle of Hong Kong on the top of a high-rise building or in the outback of Australia and you'll meet somebody that you've encountered over your career.
Oh, dear. Yeah, she does despair.
Well, can you any stories you can furnish there?
Yeah. Well, we got off the train in Brisbane.
Yeah.
And we're walking through the bus station, and guy said to me, "Liz Burton, what the hell?" and he used to be the managing director at East Midland Stagecoach East Midland.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she goes, "Awful one, absolutely awful one." I mean, we were in a pub in Stanley in Hong Kong, and. On the television and on the wall is the Liverpool Football Club fixture list.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no interest in the Bag of Wind at all. And a guy came up to me and he said, "What are you doing here?" And he was a high roller at First Bus.
Yeah.
And I got an introduction. I got an invitation to the office, and. Anyway, I left my wife to go shopping that day, and I popped up to the office, and when I go in, there's a guy there who used to be the general manager at Timeline at Trafford Park.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said to me, "Charlie Brown still hates you for your second." He said, "Oh, there's a cupboard. They've got a big cupboard there. And it's full of model buses." Well, I like collecting model buses, so I walked out with a big bag full of buses. And
we've had some great cases over the years, and I know I always remember that case. Do you remember there was a guy who said he'd been attacked,
yeah.
And someone had punched him through the perspex of the
That's
assault
right.
screen.
That's right.
And so we doubted this for a collection of reasons, and so you ended up bringing the door to the court itself, and the judge was against it. I remember the name of the judge as well. The judge was against us.
But the barrister was for
cycling it. She was. She absolutely. I remember her. She was. And so we said, no, we've paid for the party. We'll have the jelly,
yeah.
Which was the stagecoach way. It was great acting for stagecoach because they would fight things. I remember being told very, very early on from on high. Sort of, the person who was advising me what to do said, it's not the principle, it's the money.
Yeah.
And so we fought things, and we won, if you remember, we used to win cases. And so I'm pretty sure, and I have no way of proving it, that the judge came down and had a look at that perspex when we were out at lunch. Oh. I can just imagine this judge all dressed up in robes trying to punch his way through an assault screen. But I know that you've got two route masters. I know you had one route master. How did you acquire that, and did you do it up yourself?
First one we acquired was when I was at the College of Commerce doing the Institute of Transport exams.
Right.
Wasn't married, and John Pollock, who's I've known a long time, said 224's coming off. Do you fancy a share? So I said, oh, how much? He said, oh, it'd be £30. So yeah, I reached in my back pocket, not married, loads of money, £30. So we've had it 40 odd years now. Yeah. And then there's a guy called George Philpott and Peter Cornt, who lives in Australia, had this other bus, and we negotiated with them to buy it off them for a princely sum of £500. I mean, the Leyland cost us 180. But the Bristol cost us 500. And Alan Gaskell and I went down in my mother's Mini. We took the back seat out of my mother's Mini, put my toolbox and two batteries in the back seat of my mother's Mini, went down to Haverford West and drove it back with trade plates. I mean, before AMPR or anything like that. It'll run. It didn't. We had to file all the contacts, so it was a right mess. We got it going, and we didn't stop. We were frightened of stopping it in case we couldn't start it again, so we drove all the way back. And when we stopped, we put a piece of wood under the accelerator to keep the engine running.
Well, in our office at Backhouse Jones, we have a collection of memorabilia in our boardroom, which you've kindly given to us over the years, and we've got bus ticket machines going back to the 1930s, and it's a great way of clients coming to the office and literally feeling suddenly at ease because they see the memorabilia around them, and they suddenly think, yeah, I think this is what this firm does. It sort of sets us apart, hopefully. So George Lucas, who says that whenever he goes anywhere, he's always introduced as George Lucas, the founder of Star Wars. Well, Les Burton, the creator of Bus Wars and the winner of the Bus Wars in Manchester, thank you very much indeed for being the inaugural backstory interviewee. It's been a fascinating interview, and for me it's been a fascinating 20 plus years that we've acted for Stagecoach, and thank you for coming along. And that's the first one over with, and hopefully I'll be back.